They're not our friends. They would like to take us over militarily wise and economically wise. My handheld is a Yaesu FT-60.
Is that Richie? Is that it, Richie, or is there more to that?
No, not more to that, but I get very upset when people decide to favor Chinese products when good American products are available. And to you.
But in your case, you're favoring Japanese products, not American products. So the question is, are the Japanese bigger friends than the Chinese? I don't think countries are friends. I think countries have their own interests, and if their interests serve to be friendly, they're friendly, and when it serves not to be friendly, they're not friendly. And some countries can produce things much more economically than others. And the United States is known for really high-class research and development. People walk around with iPhones. iPhones are put together in China. They're designed in the United States. A lot of the silicon is designed in the United States. Sometimes it's done in Israel. It's a big world, and you can't just kind of lock the doors, because that's what the Japanese did a few centuries ago, and that didn't really work well for them.
Well, we're at peace with Japan, but not really at peace with China. And, I lost my train of thought, but, I try and buy American or Jap. If I have to. The radios are sending us a perfect. I believe China's motive is to put his country out of business. They're not our friends. And do you remember they were selling cat and dog food? I don't know what it had in it. It was poisoning poor animals. And then they sold toys to children with lead paint.
Well, Richie, this is probably better suited for our political net that begins at 12:07 a.m., but they don't only do it to the outside world, unfortunately. There are a lot of thieves and scoundrels in China. There's a lot of money to be made, and there's a lot of people cutting corners. There was a very big problem with fake vaccinations in China, where they were selling vaccines that weren't effective. To newborn Chinese children, there is still to this day a run on non-Chinese milk formula from outside of China because of the melamine contamination that they experienced themselves. So it's not that they're doing this not particularly to us; they're doing it to their own people. It's just thieves and scoundrels, which is probably one of the few international things that most nations have in common. And as far as the Japanese, you talk to Barry, your friend. The Japanese were not our friends back in World War II, to the extreme. They became our friends, but I remember the 1980s where we were very afraid that they were buying up the country and that they had lost World War II, and they were going to make it up by just buying the whole country until they had an economic collapse and they had to sell everything for pennies on the dollar. So politics and economics and all that is very complicated, and when you try and simplify it, it just kind of goes nowhere.
Comment in one whitey white.
Thanks, sure.
Just want to remind you also in the 1980s, our friends the Japanese, through the corporation of Toshiba, took very sensitive propeller technology that we had given them for their submarines and sold it to the Soviets. And the Soviet attack submarines went quiet over a 3-month period.
Hey, thanks, Hank. That's what I'm saying. There's no such thing as a permanent friend among states. States are out for their own state, and whatever they can get away with, they'll try and get away with. If it serves their purpose to be friendly, they'll be friendly. If it serves their purpose to rattle swords, they'll rattle swords. It's not effective to dress up everyone in white hats and black hats and go from there on. So I caution people to read a lot and try and figure out what's going on behind everything. And it's usually something to do with power and money and influence and prestige. Anyway, on to my puzzler for tonight. It's probably going to be a short one, but what the heck, let's give it a try. Modern ship hulls are painted red. So my question is, well, many of them are painted red. So my question for tonight for anyone interested in playing is, why do you think that so many ships are painted red on the bottom?
VDH with a comment?
Yes, John.
I think that has something to do with red light being absorbed by water. I think water absorbs very heavily going into the infrared and the red end of the spectrum, right?
Okay, so how would that benefit the ship?
It might help in concealing them. Well, I guess you wouldn't want them concealed, but I'm just going to say it'll have something to do with the absorption of red light. Go ahead.
Okay, that's a good one. Anyone else with any ideas of why a lot of ships are painted red on the bottom?
KC Sue MDP.
Yes.
If I'm not correct, I do believe it has to do with something with the copper in the paint, that the copper keeps away the algae and the barnacles and so forth. Back to you.
Very good. Give that man a gold star. It's because more of historical reasons than it is for practical reasons. Nowadays, there's coatings for the bottom of ships that lessen the chances of barnacles and sea worms kind of sticking onto the side of the ship. But in the olden days, they used copper compounds, and that usually gave the bottom of the ship a red color. And it's become tradition almost that sailors kind of are used to seeing red-colored bottoms of boats. So it's no longer the copper oxides that are making it red. People are just putting red pigments in anti-barnacle and other pest protective surfaces on the back. So it right now it's more of a tradition, but it was based originally on a very clever knowledge of how copper compounds are helpful in lessening the amount of detritus collecting on the surface, on the bottom surface of boats.
Comment, and one whitey way.
Yes, thanks.
There's also the aesthetics of it. Today, many anti-fouling paints are equally effective, but they still allow small amounts of growth, usually slime, to adhere, and the red bottoms tend to show that less. So if you have a sailing-type vessel, one which heals and therefore exposes its bottom on one side, as opposed to a powerboat, which tends to do much better with an ablative anti-fouling, the sailing vessel prefers a red coating, or many sailors prefer a red coating, because it actually hides some of the green slime.
A whole lot of decades ago, Roy, people who were buying the paint to put it on their canoe or their rowboat or whatever, it was called red lead paint. Maybe that's just a funny name, but I wonder if it ever really contained lead, and if that would help create a rejection from barnacles. Over to you, Roy, KTRIW.
Well, the big problem with the paint in the old days was that a lot of different paints had lead in it. It was, it suited the chemistry. Unfortunately, it didn't take into account the condition called pica, which is, little children and some adults who are a little bit off their rocker will pull off little paint chips and swallow them. and get lead poisoning. So I would believe that it contained lead, because lead was a very common additive for paints up until only about, say, 30, 40 years ago.
Actually, another comment from Whitey White.
Yes, Hank.
Yeah, that's that very recently they just got rid of the tributyl tin that was in many anti-fouling paints, non-ablative anti-fouling paints, and that stuff was extremely effective, but the EPA banned it because they said it was killing marine life, not just on the boat, adhering to the boat, but in the vicinity of the boat, and it became a minor cottage industry for people to sail their boats over to the Bahamas, where there was no such ban, have the work done, and bring them back.
That's reminiscent of when refrigerants were having problems and people started to store up their Freon for when it was going to be illegal. So there's always the case of that. There are people with stockpiles of DDT and all kinds of fun, dangerous stuff that kills a lot of things.
Yep, I still got my R12 30-pounder sitting in the basement.
Okay, I mean, unfortunately, safety kind of screws other things up. I'm sure everyone has enjoyed dealing with the new lead-free solder that's being promoted as a much healthier alternative. Unfortunately, it really stinks as solder. So I don't know of anyone who voluntarily uses that stuff, but that's what the powers that be would like everyone to use, because heavy metal lead is a toxic material, and ingested can cause many forms of damage.
Comments and to Rio.
Yes, Rich.
I learned how to solder when I was 9 years old. I'm now going to be 70 this coming April. I have had no problem with leaded solder, and that's still what I use.
I'm glad to hear that, Rich, but there are people who suffer from lead poisoning for different reasons. As I mentioned before, there's pica. As children, they ate a lot of paint chips that contained lead, and lead is very dangerous, especially to young brains that are growing, and so lead to deficits in their learning abilities. And there are even cases now of people who've been shot with lead bullets, because most bullets are lead, and they've noticed that the amount of lead in their bloodstream can be as high as 10 or 20 times higher than a normal person's bloodstream, and that's probably not terribly good for them either. Now, I agree with you I don't think that you really got that much lead in your experience of soldering with lead, and I think it's a little overkill, and I think the substitutes are awful. I guess their heart is in the right place, even if their brain might not be.
Yes, correct. I don't want the government telling me what I can use. They should stay out of electronics. This Wohatz, I don't even think the government buys it. Is that true?
There are specific government programs to say you will not use lead-free solder on this program because it's an unreliable solder which grows dendrites and creates short circuits and whatever. It doesn't make a reliable joint. And I think there are a number of articles saying that all of the lead solder that was used on printed circuit boards, the rate at which that is leaching into the environment is so extremely slow, even though a lot of those PC boards might be sitting in a dump site somewhere, that the whole Rojas situation appears to be an overreaction. Over to you, Roy, TTRIW.
I agree with you entirely, Dick. It's the pendulum swings too much the one end, too much the other end, and hopefully settles somewhere as a compromise in the middle. We don't need to have lead in paint anymore. There's a lot of chemistry that makes very good paint that has no lead. We don't need lead that much in gasoline, even though I gave you the story of the 170,000 airplanes that still use low-leaded gas. So some things are worth the trouble, and some things aren't. And it takes time to auto-correct, and I think the nonsense with lead solder is going to eventually correct itself over time. I mean, I have a nice big spool of 60-40, and I'm not going to give it up either.
Oh, good to you, Roy. Roy, I have a question on another subject. If I could, with now or later, it doesn't matter.
Hey, Rich, now is as good as any time.
Oh, thank you, Roy. My new cat, he's a five-month-old kitten. He has six toes on his front paws. I don't think that's too common. I guess it's nature, evolution. I would assume the survival of the fittest. If you remember going in your medical practice to people that were born with six rather than five fingers.
Yeah, there are many different conditions, genetic mutations, sometimes drug reactions where fingers actually fuse and they have less than five fingers, or you could have an extra one. It's not evolution per se. It's not survival of the fittest. It's just an example of mutation. Now, if your cat wasn't going to be spayed, and for some odd reason having six claws was better for it to survive than five claws, then it would breed, and some of them would have six claws, and those would survive to a better percentage than the five clawed version. And so over time, you'd have this collection of that trait become stabilized from just a random mutation to a property of a good percentage of the species. And that's how evolution works. You get a mutation. Sometimes they're beneficial. Sometimes they're detrimental. Sometimes they're neither. And if they're beneficial, through successive generations, evolution tends to amplify the number of people with that useful trait.
Okay, well, it doesn't seem to be creating a problem. He doesn't know the difference. I adopted him last month from the ASPCA. And by the way, go on my website, the QRZ website. I got a picture of me holding him. Might be something cute to look at.
KC2, MDP.
It's MDP.
Yes, my friend's daughter just got a cat, and according to her, that's a Maine Coon cat. It has six toes on its front feet, and it's called a Maine Coon cat.
And one whitey white.
Yes, Hank, one thing, polydactyly is what this condition is called, and it's very common among Maine Coon cats, but other cats can have it as well. It's a genetic abnormality. Again, it seems to have been reinforced in Maine Coon cats, but Hank, what do you want to say?
Roy, you just said it. That was my point. It was polydactylism, and it's available in, not available, but it is more common in Maine Coon cats than in other breeds, but there are certain locations in this country where it seems to have been selectively bred into the kittens. I'm thinking specifically of Key West, Florida, where the majority of kittens that are in the animal rescue services are polydactyl. And, of course, a guy named Ernest Hemingway maintained an estate there where he bred polydactyl cats.
Isn't there also the possibility, Roy, that domestic cats are subjected to a significant amount of inbreeding? An awful lot of the breeding probably is breeding between the third, fourth, and fifth cousins, and that would increase the amount of of defects, so to speak. Over to you, Roy. KQRIW.
That's an enormous problem. We kind of mentioned it a couple of months ago, especially with different dog breeds. They are so inbred. They've bred them with such physical, the shortened snout, everything's pulled and pushed and deformed, and it causes a lot of structural problems. And in interbreeding repeatedly, there's a lot of genetic disorders. There's a lot of tendency of bone malformations and different forms of cancer. So it's sort of a shame what we've been doing to man's best friend. It's probably the healthiest dog that you could get would be a incredibly mixed mutt breed.
And Julia, what is a cat? What do you call it? Something? Coon cat? I don't understand the derivation.
There's a type of cat called a Maine, M-A-I-N-E, like the state of Maine, Maine Coon's cat. It's a variety.
Okay. Well, it doesn't seem to be doing any harm. It doesn't help or harm them. I adopted them from the ASPCA. I don't know if there was any inbreeding. What I understand, a lady brought them in. She had a cat that got pregnant, and she brought four kittens in. He had brothers and a sister.
You have to understand, Richie, that a lot of times when they don't know who the father is, usually people who have one cat have a bunch of cats. And if you have a bunch of female cats and one male cat, chances are you're going to have inbreeding, if you don't spay or neuter your cat. It's possible the female cat could have found a male somewhere in the neighborhood. I don't know. But there's a bigger chance of inbreeding for people with dogs and cats who don't neuter them.
Well, he is neutered. I had a certificate for rabies. He had a distemper shot, but he's going to the vet in the beginning of September. Is there anything I might want to tell the vet that you could think of?
Oh, I would assume a veterinarian knows exactly what to do with a young cat.
Okay, I'm just bringing up the possibility, and of course we don't know if it was inbred. And I agree with you, dogs, mutts are the best dogs.
Generally, they are the healthiest. But, if your cat is due to some kind of inbreeding, there's nothing much you can do about it except love it and take good care of it and give it a good life.
Oh, absolutely. He's very playful. He likes to sit in my lap and play all day and night, but I can't do it all day and night. But I do give him a lot of care.
And WS2M, when you get a chance for a different topic, back to you, Roy.
Okay, Paul, we will move on to the next topic, if that's okay with you, Richie.
It certainly is.
Okay, the next one is a little bit more than an update of the story that Paul mentioned last week. The adventures of Mad Mike Hughes in his never-ending attempt to prove that the world is flat or troll every single human being on this earth, including that fellow in the White House. Flat Earth proponent, former limo driver and amateur rocketeer, Mad Mike Hughes, planned to launch his 5,000-foot missile rocket into the air above the community of Amboy in California's Mojave Desert on August 12th. But his homemade steam-powered rocket never got off the ground thanks to a faulty water heater that he bought off of Craigslist. According to Hughes' publicist, Darren Schuster, the faulty heater that Hughes bought for $325 off of Craigslist wasn't able to heat the water to 400 degrees Fahrenheit, the temperature required to create the steam to propel the rocket. Hughes paid $50 for the nose cone of the rocket, which he plans to launch off the back of a semi-truck he was gifted. Schuster added that no one knows where the nose cone came from or what its original intent was, but Hughes modified it for its current purpose on his rocket. The launch is sponsored by a company called HUD, a casual dating app. Let me drop for a second. Quote, I appreciate the support, love, and excitement from everybody, and a delay will not stop my mission. The rocket is in place and needs a leak plugged up, so weekend is a go, end quote, Hughes told reporters. Hughes, 63 years old, previously launched in March 2018 to an altitude of 1,875 feet aboard his steam-powered rocket, which he modified for that launch. Hughes walked away from last year's launch sore and with a compressed vertebra. So even if he is able to launch again and survive the landing, it remains to be seen how Hughes will fare after reaching these new heights. In media coverage, the 2018 launch, a number of publications stated that Hughes was launching to see the Earth's curvature for himself. However, Hughes told reporters that he was launching this higher altitude because simply he is a daredevil. Quote, I believe the Earth is flat, end quote, Hughes said. But this flat Earth has nothing to do with the steam rocket launches, he added. I never did, and I never will. I am a daredevil. Still, soon after he attempted the launch on August 11th, Hughes gave another motivation for his latest launch attempt, President Donald Trump. This launch is about my personal desire to inspire my fellow Americans to help make this country great again, he said in a press statement, adding that he hopes his feat will garner an invitation to the White House for himself and his launch crew. Trump is the greatest president since there's been a president, he said. And he also added, I intend to spread the word about MAGA with my homegrown steam-powered manned rocket. I am the homegrown rocket man. While it's difficult to pinpoint Hughes' true intentions in risking his life by launching himself into the sky, this Trump-centric rebrand may be another attempt to generate more attention and therefore more funding for the next launch, which he hopes will take him all the way to the Kármán line, a boundary of 62 miles above the Earth's surface that represents the beginning of space. Now, he was supposed to launch it this weekend. I have not seen any news of whether he did or whether he didn't. It's very strange that he schedules these things on the weekend and you only read the results on the weekdays. So hopefully in the next few days we'll hear if he took off he got off the ground and if he came back onto the ground. Anyway, let me drop for any questions or comments. This is AC2GS.
N1YDY.
Yes, Hank.
How high did you say he got the first time?
Excuse me, how high did he get?
He said he had two launches, a previous launch in 18. How high was his altitude, max altitude?
I believe it was 1,875 feet.
And from 1,800 feet, he hopes to get to 62 miles? Is that what you said his goal was for today?
Oh, he's not even looking for the Kármán line this time. This time, he's just going to go a little bit farther up. He's going to inch up on the Kármán line, you know, some point later in life.
WS2N.
Thank you, guys.
Yes, Paul.
Yeah, you're right about the 5,000 feet, and that's with the steam-powered rocket. But his goal is, like you said, to get to the Kármán line. He's going to use a different rocket. He wants to use one with hydrogen peroxide. He wants to attach it to a balloon, send the balloon up as high as it can go. Usually the most they can get up is, you know, if he's lucky, he can get up to 20 miles, you know, 100,000 feet or something. It's probably where he'll wind up. And then from there, drop from the balloon, with his hydrogen peroxide rocket and shoot up another, you know, like 40 miles into the air straight up until he gets to the common mind. So I think he's a long way from that, though. But that's his ultimate plan.
I tend to think his ultimate plan is just to have a lot of strangers talking about him, which he's succeeding at.
Well, he's already done that. But there's always, he's serious. I mean, he did bump himself into the last one. But, you know, I mean, Evel Knievel was serious, too. He had a steam-powered rocket. It was originally going to be a motorcycle, but he got a steam-powered rocket. He got it up to 5,000 PSI and tried to shoot himself over Snake River Canyon. He wanted to do the Grand Canyon, but the government at the time said, no, you're not doing that. So he went to Snake River up in Idaho. Back to you, Rick.
Some reason, I get the sense that Mad Mike was not given the attention by his mother and father when he was young, and this is what happened. So take care of your children, people.
I concur. Whenever you get a chance, I do have a question, really a comment, an observation that I did today. Back to you, Ron.
Sure. Give it to us.
Okay, I have a relatively new cell phone. It's Samsung. And I have, I'm trying everything out. So I want to try it out, the pictures and try it out, the video, and see how this works and that works. So I was outside today, and I wear sunglasses. And I'm looking at the picture, screen. And, I'm holding it vertically, and I can see it. But then I figured, let me turn it, in the landscape view, on the side. When I turned it, black screen. What is going on? This is a brand new phone. This shouldn't happen. So after, investigating and trying another phone, and the same thing happened on another phone, I realized this is the sunglasses. The sunglasses are polarized. Because of the LED screen, it completely blacked out. It's incredible. I mean, there's nothing wrong with the phone. I put on regular glasses, good to go. Sunglasses, it won't work in that landscape mode. So it's pretty cool, interesting. I thought I'd just bring it up. Back to you, Roy.
Sure, it is, to me, very interesting. It's the basis of how liquid crystal displays actually work, even going back to the oldest, not terribly attractive kind of, we think of it as black and white, but it was really kind of a dark gray and black. What's going on with liquid crystal displays from the very first one to the magic ones these days is that there are polarizers. That polarize the light to a certain angle, and then there's a liquid crystal material with electrodes, and then there's another layer of polarizing filters. If there wasn't anything going on with the liquid crystals, the two polarizing filters at 90 degrees from each other would black everything out. But if you apply an electrical current to the liquid crystal material, it rotates the polarization angle of the light so that more light goes through the second polarizer than it would when it's not energized. Now, if you suit it up with TFT thin film transistors to boost the power, and you put a lot of bright light behind it, you get modern day full color liquid crystal displays. But they all basically work with polarizing filters, which you notice when you were wearing another polarizing filter.
Yeah, and I mean black. I mean, like the screen was off, so it was pretty amazing. Now, I think, let me look on the internet, and I could found very little. I found one or two people making a comment about it back in 2015, And one person said it won't work with the OLED, the organic light-emitting diode screen. So I know somebody with that screen. Next time I go over there, I'm gonna give it a try and see if that's true. But they're probably right because individual pixels are actually lighting up. The regular LCDs combination of LED LCD is different.
So organic light-emitting diodes are a purely emissive technology. They don't block any light. They emit and show off all the color and all the light that they produce in the display, whereas liquid crystal devices are subtractive. They'll take the background of either a cold fluorescent light or a white balanced light-emitting diode background, and they'll subtract out by these little tricks of polarizing the plane of the light. So it's subtractive rather than emissive. So yeah, you'll notice the difference immediately when you look at organic light-emitting diode displays. They have no polarizers whatsoever. They don't need them.
Very good explanation. Very good. Yeah, I was thinking, well, maybe it has to do with my glasses. You know, I actually wear trifocals. Most people have the progressive ones. I thought, well, maybe something to do with this. But then after looking into it, I realized this is not. But back in the early 1970s, when they came out with polarized sunglasses, you know, it was a thing. You would grab two people's sunglasses, and you would, you'd look through it, and you would rotate one, and sure enough, it would black out what you were looking at, at 90 degrees. So it was that all over again, but this time with a modern cell phone. Back to you, Roy. WS2M.
I used to use polarizing filters all the time. I had polarizing filters on my camera's lenses because the reason why they use a polarizer with sunglasses is because the reflected light tends to have a slightly polarized percentage. And so if you have your polarizers at 90 degrees from the angle of the polarizing reflections, it blanks out some of the reflection. So polarizers are fascinating subjects. As a matter of fact, there's loads of YouTube where they demonstrate a very curious effect that if you have two, as I said before, if you have two polarizing filters and they're at 90 degrees orientation from each other, is they almost emit no light whatsoever. And it sort of makes sense that you have something that's totally horizontally polarized getting through the first filter, and then when you hit a vertical filter at 90 degrees, there's nothing left for it to go through, so you block it and it's black. But the weird thing is, if you take a third piece of polarizing material, it's 45 degrees, and you put it between the two, you see light again. So the problem in trying to figure out, if the light is already polarized, 90 degrees and you have a 0 degree filter, putting something in between shouldn't really change anything. It maybe absorb a little bit more light, but it actually effectively rotates the polarity of the light that's emitted. So it's no longer at 90 degrees, and because it's no longer at 90 degrees from the second top polarizer, you can see light come. So polarizers are loads of fun to play with.
Okay, yeah, I'll look at some of those YouTubes and websites. Sounds good. Very good, Roy. I thought I'd just bring that up. I've never heard anybody discuss it before, and like I said, it's far and few between on the internet. You put in just that information, polarized light, cell phone, some kind of combination like that, and you get really nothing. Back to you, Roy. I'll be listening.
Okay, very good. Let me move on to my next story, which is also a little bit about what we talked about last week. We're kind of stuck in a time warp. Russia's experiment with something radioactive seems to have gotten out of hand. Russian scientists have indicated that they were working on miniaturized sources of nuclear energy when a rocket engine exploded last week, increasing scrutiny of the possibility that the accident occurred while testing an experimental cruise missile powered by a small reactor. The explosion happened last Thursday at a military testing ground in Russia's Arkhangelsk region, and it killed, they said, at least five people and caused radiation readings in the neighborhood to spike to 20 times their normal level for a half an hour. There seems to be a lot of confusion about this. Some reports say that in addition to the five people killed, there might have been even more people who died. There's footage that's been released of a string of ambulances that seem to be hastily duct tape sealed in the back, racing down a Russian street, bringing victims of that to a nearby hospital. There's been reports that the hospital staff failed to be informed that they were dealing with radiation contamination and that they themselves had to be transported to a Moscow hospital later on for their own secondhand case of radiation exposure. And Russian authorities have been, as usual, as clear and transparent on all this as their infamous Russian mud, which I'm told is quite corrosive. Let me drop for a second and then I'll be back. Russia's defense ministry said the explosion had taken place during testing of a rocket engine, but the country's nuclear agency, Rosatom, later confirmed that several of its employees had been killed during testing of an isotope power source in a liquid propulsion system. David Cullen, the director of Nuclear Information Service in the United Kingdom, said about this last Monday that the view among independent experts was that the explosion appeared to have been caused by a failure of an experimental nuclear-powered cruise missile known in Russia as the 9M730 Burisnik and by NATO as the SSCX-9 Skyfall. Announced by the Russian President Vladimir Putin in 2018, the missile is theoretically capable of using onboard source of nuclear fuel to heat fast-moving air and fly for an indefinite period of time. Moscow has touted the missile's unlimited range and potential ability to penetrate the United States missile defenses, but doubts remain among researchers as to whether this core technology is even viable. Experts in Russia's nuclear program have also spotted the nuclear fuel carrier ship Severenka near the site of the last week's explosion, where it's believed to have taken part in the recovery effort. The vessel had previously been spotted in the waters near Novaya Zemlya, where Russia reportedly tested that strange ballistic missile in 2017. Quote, "Our suspicion is that something went terribly wrong during or after a Russian test of its nuclear-powered cruise missile," wrote Jeffrey Lewis, a U.S. Arms control specialist with Middlebury Institute of International Studies. Russia was believed to have moved to Burevsnik testing to the current Nenasko site earlier this year. Let me drop for a sec. In a video statement released last Sunday evening, an official from the Russian Federal Nuclear Center, where five employees were said to be killed in the explosion, said that the agency was working on a number of experimental technologies, including miniaturized sources of energy using fissile materials. Guy Vyacheslav Solyov, the center's scientific director, said similar work on small-scale nuclear reactors is also taking place in the United States. He did not say how much fissile material had been involved in this accident or what role it may have played in the explosion. Quote, "We are now trying to understand. We are working closely with a government commission analyzing the entire chain of events to assess the scale of the accident and to understand its causes," Solovyov said. The slow release of information has heightened concerns that a major incident took place offshore from the Nenasko missile testing site. Residents of Severodvinsk and other northern cities had reportedly stocked up on iodine, which reduced the effects of exposure to radiation. Russia has also closed a bay in the White Sea near where the accident took place and planning to do it for a month, apparently, indicating a possible contamination or a continued the development of experimental weapons, such as the Sputnik, would also help to explain the secrecy around the incident despite public concerns over radiation levels. The U.S. tried and failed to develop ground-hugging nuclear-powered cruise missile technology during the Cold War, and questions remain as to whether the Burevestnik has a meaningful purpose given the existence of high-flying intercontinental ballistic missiles as an alternative. Such experimental long-term cruise missiles would not have been covered in the Intermediate-Range Nuclear Force Treaty between the United States and Russia that lapsed this last month, because it only banned land-based cruise missiles with a range of between 300 and 3,400 miles. Cullen said, however, that the test failure was symptomatic of a wider escalation of nuclear tensions stemming from a gradual breakdown in United States-Russia relations, partly because Russia is trying to rectify what it believes is a strategic disadvantage it has against the United States by developing non-conventional capabilities. Let me drop for any questions or comments. This is AC2GS.
Comment, W2HL.
Yes, Howie.
Yeah, you're mentioning Chernobyl. My wife, Ina's sister, an whole family was affected by Chernobyl. Her sister died, was blinded and disfigured from it, and died. And mother had cancer, father, and also Ina had thyroid cancer. They did not do anything. The Russian government did not do anything to help these people. The government did not do anything to help these people for the accident.
Yes, that's my understanding as well. Most of their efforts involved covering things up. And apparently they pulled the same sports book and they're playing the same plays, because they were going to remove an entire town located nearby in trains across country, and they called it off at the very end and decided, no, there's no real reason to do it.
Check USO on that. Yeah, I just wanted to relay that. Thank you very much, Roy. Back to you.
You're welcome. Next story is more involved in it than I am. The self-driving freight truck startup, Too Simple, has been carrying mail across the state of Arizona for Thursday. That its venture capital arm had made a minority investment in the company Too Simple. The announcement also revealed that since May, Too Simple's autonomous trucks have been hauling UPS loads on a 115-mile route between Phoenix and Tucson. Around the same time as the UPS and Too Simple program began, the United States Postal Service and Too Simple publicized a two-week pilot program to deliver mail between Phoenix and Dallas, a 1,000-mile trip. Too Simple claims it can cut the average cost of shipping in a tractor trailer by 30%. In an announcement about the new partnership, UPS Ventures managing partner Todd Lewis said that the venture arm collaborates with startups to explore new technologies and tailor them to help meet our specific needs. Too Simple puts its own autonomous technology, which relies on 9 cameras and 2 LIDAR sensors, in a Navistar vehicle. The partnership announced states that Too Simple has been helping UPS understand how to get to level 4 autonomous driving, where a vehicle is fully autonomous and able to reach a particular location. At this point, the Too Simple trucks carrying packages for UPS still have an engineer and a safety driver riding along. When UPS reaches level 4, it won't need anyone behind the wheel. So let me drop for any questions or comments. This is AC2GS.
WS2N, just want to go back one topic, back to the nuclear missiles.
Yeah, sure, Paul.
Yeah, you mentioned we tried to do that in the early 60s. It was called Project Pluto. That's the name they gave it. And it might be similar. I mean, they think that what the Russians are doing, according to this one guy I listened to, this Scott Manley, he's really good with
but it,
well, the rockets, how they work, you know, the theories behind them, and he thinks it might be chemical rockets, you know, to get it going, and then fast enough, and then you create a ramjet for the air that's coming into the front of their rocket, and then you have the nuclear-powered, you know, creating a tremendous amount of heat, heating that air that's coming in, the cold air that's coming in, you know, in the ramjet, by heating it, you know, that becomes the exhaust, and that, then you'd be able to sustain a continuous flight with these things. That's the present theory, one guy anyway, and it's very similar to Project Pluto, which we tried to do, but gave up. It was way too dangerous with the radiation. Back to you, Roy.
Well, thank you, and I think what the Russians have successfully done is prove once again how dangerous it is. Hopefully they'll let this lie and go on to other fiendish things like strange poisons and that they can take over to England and kill expatriates and such, but who knows? I don't have a clue how their minds work, but it's a dangerous technology, and I don't think it's that terribly effective. I'm sure that there are safer ways of accomplishing that much fear and anxiety in people, but who knows?
Okay, very good. That's what you get when you drop nuclear treaties between countries, I think. All right, I'll be listening.
Yeah, but strictly, this weapon wouldn't have qualified for that treaty. It's not within the descriptor of it. But still, it's just people rattling their sabers once again, which is something that human beings love to do.
Oh, really? I thought being nuclear would have qualified. Okay. Back to you, Roy.
I said, it's not enough to be nuclear. You have to have more weapons, and they have to be multiple delivery systems and all kinds of things. I don't know. Boys and their toys, as the saying goes. Anyway, I know that Rich, K2 UPS, is on Echo Link. Hopefully he's listening to us, and I thought maybe he would want to offer some insight into that last story. So let me pause for a little while and see if he picks up on the Echo Link.
Good evening,
Ryan.
Can you hear me okay?
Yeah, we hear you, Rich.
I think you probably know I'm actually currently at this moment in AUPS back to Dallas, so this story is of interest to me. However, a few things. One, they started doing this out in Arizona for one of the biggest reasons is Arizona is one of the right to work states, so you do not have to be in a union to work for UPS, unlike New York and then a lot of the other states. Now, whether this technology ever makes it into New York, they're going to have a very long road to deal with the unions over that. I have been 2 years to risk losing my job, but I'll be retired long before that happens. But it is new technology. Something else I know that they're looking into is called platooning, where they'll take two or three trucks starting from different points in a city, let's say New York City, for instance, and they will then meet up on an interstate and form a chain, not physically connected, but connected wirelessly, and they travel extremely close to one another with the lead truck controlling the two behind it. There's drivers in all three, but the drivers in position two and position three, after they are in the platoon position, are basically doing nothing but sitting there. And then when they get to their destination, they would then break off and go to their respective buildings or loading docks. I mean, obviously UPS is going to keep trying to cut costs any way they can and modernize it. Streamline their operations. We are already using drones to deliver packages in Europe. So they've been doing that for a while. Small packages, obviously, they can be lifted by a drone, but they are doing that. They take off from the roof of the brown, typical brown UPS package car, The driver loads it while inside the truck, opens up a hatch, and the thing takes off, flies, delivers it. And even if he moves the truck, the drone knows where the truck is, comes back, lands, and puts the drone back in again. So, interesting stuff.
That's interesting stuff. We live in curious times. The technology gives us great benefits, but it also gives us these enormous questions. Little by little, people's jobs are ceasing to exist and have become automated. And they're all over the place. Automatic self-driving cars. There are artificial intelligence computer algorithms that make diagnostic medicine decisions. There are computer-assisted, robotic surgeries. It's not bizarre to think that there'll come a time when most people won't be necessary just to keep oiling the machinery and what have you. And so it'll be curious to see how civilization refocuses their time and their efforts in some productive way that doesn't lead to a great deal of anger, rebellion, and shooting of each other.
Comment in one whitey white.
Yes, Hank.
In the Union magazine for airline pilots, there was a description of what they perceived the first level of automation would be. And that would essentially be one where the tug drivers still exist and people move the airplanes out to the taxiway into the order that they need to go manually by somebody on the ground pushing a tug along. And then once it was in line, the aircraft would be able to continue the taxi to the runway, take off, fly to destination, and be picked up by a tug and pulled into the gate. And then they said the second level of this would be, if that all worked out properly in the first level, is that they would eliminate the tug drivers. So eventually, I really don't think that my job would survive into the next century. N1 Whitey White.
Well, I pretty much agree with you, Hank. And for the life of me, I can't think of too many jobs other than the guy who clips coupons and gets his stock market margins paid and such. Other than those guys, everything else is kind of open for artificial intelligence, robotics, and all manner of things. So, again, it's sort of like we're on the cusp of something that made the machine age seem like just a stroll in the park. So it'll be curious to see what humanity does with this. I hope they don't decide to simply throw boots into the gears and sabotage everything. It's been known to happen. Okay, on with a more lighthearted story. A young woman in India unknowingly lived with one of the rarest and most unsettling medical conditions for nearly two decades. Her doctors say, according to a case report out this past week, the woman had a sac containing her still-growing twin lodged in her abdomen for the past 17 years. The twin had hair, teeth, and even a spine, formerly known as fetus in situ. The condition is thought to happen when one fetal twin gets enveloped by the other very early in pregnancy. The fetus doesn't go on to develop its own nervous system and brain, but it's still capable of living to one degree or another. And it sustains itself through its sibling, essentially becoming a parasite. Another theory holds that the second fetus is actually a complex form of tumor called a teratoma. Those tumors can develop different types of tissues at once, including hair and teeth. Regardless of how the condition happens, it usually ends in a miscarriage due to not enough nutrition available for the intact fetus. But even when someone survives, the condition is usually quickly detected soon after birth or early in childhood. Prior to this case, according to the woman's doctor, there had only been seven other reported cases of adults living with a fetal twin. And up until now, they had all been men. The women's ordeal detailed by our doctors in the British Medical Journal case reports, really began 5 years before she visited them. That's when she and her family first noticed that she had a hard, misshaped lump around her abdomen. Over the next 5 years, the lump gradually grew in size and caused her pain periodically. By the time the then 17-year-old visited the doctors, she wasn't able to eat much before feeling full, likely because the lump had started to press on her internal organs. Let me drop for a second. On the initial physical examination, the lump was suspected to be a tumor, which in a sense it was. But when they ran a CAT scan on the lump, they found deposits of calcium. It looked like the shape of...